She said, I applied to too many jobs to remember all of them in her degree field. But finding nothing, she moved home and she found part-time work at an after-school program. On the job one day, one of her elementary school teachers, when she was in elementary school, came to visit her. She had saved many of her assignments, some of her best work, in hopes to show Erica how much potential she had. Erica understood her teacher's good intentions, but by that visit, she internalized disappointment. She says this, I'd always been the smart one, and in my hometown was seen as the one of those kids with a bright future. It was a crushing blow to move home. I was supposed to create peace in the Middle East, and here I was, back in a small town. This is just one story from a plethora of stories in a book compiled by Ann Peterson. That's kind of all the rage right now. The book is called Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Social commentators have commented on what's happening in our culture right now, and it's not just millennials. One says this, burnout is the ever-present diagnosis of our modern age. Burnout is the ever-present diagnosis of our modern age. The sense of toil, the sense of the grind, sense of people saying it's hard for me to do adulting is something that has been throughout our culture over the past generation. Today, we're going to see someone that doesn't just echo the words that are now, but echoes the words that's gone for 2,000 years, very similar to how Erica was speaking, talking about work many times as toil. And that leaves us a question today. Is our work simply striving after the wind? Vanity. Vanity. How do we rescue work from the burnout in our current age? Today, as we look at Ecclesiastes, my hope is we would look just above the sun and change the way that we look at striving in our work. So let's look together, shall we? It's printed in your worship guide, Ecclesiastes chapter 4, and it's a doozy, like Ecclesiastes is. So please pay attention as I read God's word this morning. Again, I saw all the oppression that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought, the dead who are already dead, more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity in a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil in a striving after wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for who am I toiling in depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, of all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind. This is the word of the Lord. For just joining us, welcome. We are through this book called Ecclesiastes, and you might be wondering what kind of church is this to do this kind of book, but it is so rich and so good. Ecclesiastes, especially the middle portions, we have this narrator on the beginning and at the end, is kind of telling what this book is about. And in the middle is this narrative of what's called the preacher or the teacher or the philosopher, Koheleth in Hebrew. And we see that this Koheleth, who has experienced everything in life, is making observations about life. We see that here in this passage four times. He observes, he sees, and he looks under the sun for meaning. We see this statement often in Ecclesiastes. Under the sun, what does he mean? He means with all that is in the natural world, all that I can see, all my experiences, not talking about transcendence or supernatural or something above, is what he experiences in this natural world. It's a very philosophical way of thinking, but truth is many of us live our lives in this kind of way. Is there actual supernatural purpose? Do my actions have meaning? Does changing a diaper have any eternal significance? Filling out another spreadsheet, moving another rock, painting another wall, does it matter? And you see that Koheleth is getting to this idea of work. He calls toil. It's really a negative take, this word that he uses, toil. And when he says toil, he's not just talking about a job. He's talking about the labor of life, house projects, time with a pet, running races, playing Minecraft, untangling the fishing line. Toil, toil. And he uses it 10 times. And again, he ties this to vanity, to smoke, to vapor, to an enigma. Is there meaning in all of this work? At this time, you guys might be a little frustrated with this teacher, right? Stop, you're making me depressed. He's doing this on purpose. You see the narrator who narrates about what Koheleth is saying at the beginning and the end, at the end says, do you know what this teacher is doing? He's goading us. The idea of taking that sharp stick and hitting, like getting an animal to move. Goading. And that's what he's doing to us, to make us think. How much is he goading us? That it's so bad, he says, it's more fortunate for you to be dead than alive. Talk to me about a pick-me-up today, right? Well, the truth is, what is beautiful about Ecclesiastes, it starts to be honest about our experiences many times, our emotions, and our feelings. Especially when it comes around the issue of work and life. Ann Peterson, in her book, she writes this, kind of echoes thoughts that I hear many times when I talk to people in our congregation and people in Appleton at what our current moment is. She says this, we should work hard, but at the same time exude work-life balance. We should be incredibly attentive mothers, but not helicopter ones. We should engage in equal partnerships with our wives as husbands, but still maintain our masculinity. We should build our brands on social media, but live our lives still authentically. We should be current, conversant, opinionated about our breakneck news cycle, but somehow not let the reality of it affect our ability to do any of the above tasks in our life. All of this with our current economic pressures. It is these things that make us the burnout generation. Some of you can resonate with that anxiety. The idea of just waking up and doing another day and adulting. That Ecclesiastes puts words to your angst. Life is hard. How do I keep going? For some of you, you're just so good at just plugging along, you don't even think about these things. You don't think about the existential questions, the meaning of life, or what this is doing to you until many times it's too late. For you, people that just keep on plugging along, tune out this teacher, Koheleth, because he's so depressing. I hope that you would listen. And the thing is, this teacher, even though he's talking about what's under the sun, gives us moments that the clouds break, that we can see something greater, that he gives us moments above the sun. And the key word in this passage is better. There is a better way than this work and toil. I do all this setup to give you 3 points. Are you ready? You people that really like organization, here it is, right? To see the better is we have to have contentment versus envy. We have to be teachable versus being stubborn. That we have to see life as partnerships versus lonely pursuits. And those things will help us to give meaning to the toil in the work of our lives. Let's look, shall we? This first one. Then I saw, verse 4, that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity in a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than 2 hands full of toil in a striving after wind. Here is envy, he sees. All this work is about getting ahead and being better than his neighbor. This is the ancient Israel way of keeping up with the Joneses. It's nothing new. Is this all there is? Just working and toiling to get better than the other person, to make sure that I am in a better place than they are. Call it career envy or Facebook envy or FOMO or whatever it might be. Finding a job, it might look like, that it will bring fulfillment and meaning to your life, that you actually say, this is what makes my life worthwhile. Many times we have to frame these ideas within our context. A very famous speech happened in 2005, which many people argue kind of frames a lot of the generation after 2005. It was a speech by Steve Jobs of Apple, the graduation speech at Stanford. And what he said at Stanford was this: the only way to do good work is to love what you do. Implied in this is don't settle. Your work is going to fill the larger part of your life, so do what you believe is great work. How has that experiment worked out for the people of the generation after 2005? Sometimes, a lot of times, not the best. Samantha, who grew up in New England, went to college to be a teacher, heard that speech, and she said, I'm going to pursue my dreams. I'm going to pursue what is worthwhile work. And she went to school to be a teacher. But then she found out it's not all she wanted it to be. And she ended up a manager at a grocery store. And when she was interviewed, she said this, I still feel like it's not enough because it's not something I dreamt about as a kid. But does that mean it's not a good job? Did my grandfather dream of being a postman for 30 years? Probably not. But I bet no one begrudged him that good job. I love what Lewis says, C.S. Lewis. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next person. It is the comparison that makes you proud. The pleasure of being above the rest. Once the element of competition is gone, pride is gone. Viewing toil and work as envy of getting above others can many times destroy our joy for work. To be content in the gifts that God has given us, even to take jobs that people might think are not sexy or cool, that might fit us better, that might not discourage us by looking at what someone else has and we do not have. The envy also creates a barbed wire in between relationships. Rather than rejoicing in other people's gifts and what they have, we are jealous. Rather than rejoicing in the gifts that God has given us. Or maybe even ability not to be able to relate to those type of people that live on that part of town or have that kind of job. The person who works at Quick Trip is as much as value as the person who works at Lawrence University. That if you see that everything is under the sun, it would be hard to see those things as equal. But when you see that it is what is above the sun, you can then see that everyone is made in the image of God and has worth and value. And the competition and pride to get ahead might wash away. Here's the thing, though. The teacher says the pendulum can then shift the other way. Rather than envy and fighting and striving to get better and better, that some of us, with the bruised ego of pride that things have not turned out the way that we want them to, rather than competing with others, we're just not going to try anymore. Here, Kohelis says that people end up eating themselves. That the fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh. I don't think he's talking about that literally, but he's talking more about someone wasting away. The bitterness, the world is against me, self-pity. And many times what happens is the pendulum moves from striving and trying to get better than others to saying the world has passed me by, so I'll just sit where I am and be bitter about life. But verse 6, better. There is a different way than these two ways. There is something above the sun. Better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil in a striving after wind. I think what he's talking about quietness here is the word in Hebrew contentment and peace. And rather than two hands full of toil, it's the idea that I can deal with less stuff. Rather than striving in striving, that I can find peace in where I'm at. G.K. Chesterton said this, there's two ways to get enough. One is to accumulate more and more, and the other is to desire less. When you start seeing above the sun, it allows you to see that there is something else other than my own work and toil that might be able to bring contentment. A creator that made me with purpose and meaning. There's a guy in the blogosphere, his name is A.P. Frank. For my high school students out there, you know what AP means. Advanced placement. You love them. Yeah, you do. AP Frank said this in his blog. Weighted GPA, 4.83. SAT, 1570. AP classes taken, 17. Number of fives, 16. Number of times I wish my parents would see me as a person, not as a resume. 365 times 4 years of high school plus one leap year day. 1,461. Above the sun. That's what A.P. Frank wanted. That there is something greater. There is someone that loves me and cares for me rather than my production and rather than my toil. And Koheleth is getting to the depths of many times what work feels like, what life feels like. He says there is something greater. There is contentment. There is peace. Verses 13 through 16, we'll skip the middle section, we'll get back to it. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun along with that. Youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely also is vanity and a striving after the wind. Here, Koheleth gives a very incredibly sad story. Here is this king that raised up in all his toil and it disappears. It's in a vapor, it's an enigma, it goes away. Over this young one that was in prison that took his place. But the message isn't that you should be an upshot young poor buck and rise to power. Because no, it says here, even him, later they will not rejoice in him. I think what this passage is trying to say is no matter what comes and goes, that we need to realize whatever station we are in, we can still take advice, which this old king did not. He thought he was on top of the world, and he didn't need to learn anything more, and he worked and worked to get there. And now he says, I don't need to learn from anyone else. Again, what would be helpful in our toil is to realize that whatever position you're in, no matter how many people you lead, there is one that is always above you. Be teachable no matter how high you climb. No matter how high you go. I learned this early in my life. Being in Washington, D.C., I started to realize that no one was really content in where they were in their job, but only where they were going to be. I was there in 1997 during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, where Newt Gingrich was in power and impeached Bill Clinton. Then Gingrich lost his job for his own affair. Then Fred Livingston, who wanted the speaker job, got the speaker job. He was in it for 24 hours until his affair was exposed. Then he lost his job. And it just came and came and lost over and over. The climb and climb can quickly be forgotten. As many of the reformers said, no matter where we are in our station, we need to learn to be teachable. That those in their jobs that live like anything is just under the sun, they say, I have arrived. What I say goes. But those that live above the sun realize they rule by God's authority. And if you live a work that you live above the sun, you can admit your wrong to your employees. That as parents, you can say to your kids, I'm sorry. Because your authority ultimately comes from God. That it can come and go. That it's not simply getting to the next title, the next place. That instead, that even wherever you are in life, that you can be teachable. And in that teachableness, you can see what is above the sun. And then we get to the famous section, verses 7 through 12. Again, I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so he never asks, for who am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. This passage in the middle, Koheleth is observing that one person alone is never satisfied with his riches and his work, and the sadness is that he can't enjoy it with others. He doesn't even know what he is toiling about. You can think about people in history that have done that. Maybe some of you have been to the Getty Museum in California. J. Paul Getty, one of the richest men in America, fits this description that Koheleth is talking about. Getty has very famous quotes. One of them is this: if you can actually count your money, then you're not a rich man. And he lived most of his life about what mattered was what was under the sun, the material world. He would often mock this Christian ethic and say, the meek shall inherit the earth, but not its mineral rights, J. Paul Getty would say. He was married 5 times. And he said this about marriage: lasting relationships with a woman are only possible if you are a business failure. That is the kind of life that he lived. All there is, eat, drink, and be merry. Don't slow down. Get what you can. But here this passage says it's not good to be alone, but it's good to live life with others. Whether it's about marriage or friendship, we do not know. It could be either of those things. But those who live above the sun, they see that there are people that have value and meaning made in the image of God. That when you see above the sun, you see that relationships give value to your toil and work. That is simply not about yourselves, but also giving yourself in sacrifice to others. I believe Getty was right. Other people might slow you down, but that is okay. Kids or marriage, it might keep you from the advancement in a career, or money you might spend on an experience, but it gives value to the toil of life. At the end of his life, Getty, who you know, the museums, gave much of his fortune away, and he realized he had lived life the wrong way. I hate that I was a failure, he said. I hate and regret the failures of my marriages. I would gladly give all my millions for just one lasting success in a relationship. Koheleth. It's It's hard not to preach Ecclesiastes without talking about experiences and examples. It's really a book about experience. And I'm sure many of you have stories about the toils of life and work, adulting, the days in and day out that feel so weighty and so hard that you wonder, where is their meaning? Where is their purpose? It's great when people can come into your life and show you that there is something above the sun. When I was early in starting this church and church planting, I was consumed by trying to be a success, trying to make it, trying to plant a church that would make it, that my family could stay here, all of these things, and it consumed my thoughts. The great thing is about church planting, it does force you to pray. And I remember praying, God, just show me that you are here. Show me that all this toil has meaning and purpose. And one thing that God did is he brought a couple very, very early on in the church plant from Delaware. Not a typical couple. They were in retirement. And they had been praying about where they would retire. Their number one desire was to retire in Maine, where they would live the typical retired life, biking, enjoying the Maine life, all those things where a lot of people from New England would retire in Maine. But instead, this couple decided they were going to move to Appleton, Wisconsin, to be around their elderly parents. And also because they felt a call to be around a church plant and to help them. Some of you know this couple, Bruce and Carol Marker. And in their retirement, they spent time with sinners, spent time with me, labored in Bruce being one of our first elders in this church. And I'll tell you, it was not a sexy retirement. And really, if you measure life by living under the sun, it made no sense that they would spend their retirement in Appleton, Wisconsin. I remember Bruce was dying. And we as a church decided we're going to go to the assisted living home where he was at in his last few days. And he was in a wheelchair next to his wife, Carol, this couple that had ministered to many of us, mentored us, counseled us all of this time. And it was just a small church. There was 50 of us at that time. And here we are gathered in a circle, and we all sang praise songs around this couple and singing and rejoicing in who God is. And one of the assisted living people that was working there, as we sang for like an hour or so, one of the people at the assisted living place said to one of us, they said, "Who are you people? What are you doing?" And they were just kind of like, it wasn't mean, it was like they're just blown away by what was happening. See, it was moments like that. In all the toil, in all the striving, in all the work to make a church work, that God showed me, there is something above the sun. There is something more. We get this every week. This is the toil that Jesus did. God wasn't outside of work and struggle and pain. His life under the sun, he was rejected by others. He was a king deposed. Those with power oppressed him to the point of death. Our Savior knows the toil and pain of life, but he shows us something else. That life is not just what is under the sun. That there is something better. He humbled himself. He faced death. He gave up his crown. So that when we take communion, we have a picture of what resurrection is. We have a picture of what he did. That he can redeem even our toil, even our work, because we know that he has taken the work of the world and redeemed it himself by his resurrection from the dead.